Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And today we have a special podcast. I'm very pleased to tell you that we have my old friend and colleague Fiona Hill on the show. And we're here to talk about her book, There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. I have known Fiona for 30 years. We met a very long time ago, and I've followed her career, her meteoric career, for those decades. We started as Russia hands. Do people still say that, Fiona? Russia hands?
Yeah, I don't know whether they do, actually.
I don't think they say that. That's okay. Yeah, they don't say that anymore, Russia hand. No, exactly. But we were people that studied Russia. And Fiona went one direction, and I went a different direction, but we stayed in touch. And I was very pleased when I saw that she had written this book. And I said to Fiona, hey, let's talk about this book on the New Books Network, because I bet the listeners will be very interested, and I'm sure that you will be. Fiona, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marshall. It's great to be here with you.
Absolutely. Maybe we could begin the interview by just having you tell a little bit about yourself, what you're doing now. What is your current position, and what's going on with you?
Well, currently I'm at the Brookings Institution, although I'm saying currently because it's all virtual. So currently I'm actually sitting in my home in Maryland, you know, which is some distance from the Brookings Institution because, you know, everything's on Zoom. I occasionally go in for meetings, but, you know, with COVID and the pandemic shutdown, we haven't really got back into business again. And I've been at Brookings as a senior fellow one way or another for the past 20 years. And in that time, I've been loaned out twice to the US government, once to the National Intelligence Council back in 2006 to 2009, then most recently with the National Security Council under the Trump administration, 2017 to 2019. So Brookings has been, for the last 20 years, my kind of permanent home. And before that, you know, when you and I first met, I was at Harvard for many years doing PhD like you did in Russian history and, you know, studying, but also working at the Kennedy School of Government on various technical assistance projects. And then I had a brief stint in between with the Eurasia Foundation in Washington, D.C. So that's been me for the last 30-odd years.
Well, it's really good to talk to you. It's funny you mention about everything being on Zoom. I had a call the other day with some people, actually it was people from Cambridge University Press, and there were like five people on the call, and one of them was in an office. And we all remarked like, oh my God, you're in an office. That's weird. All the rest of us were in like our bedrooms. They were in an office. So we have a kind of a traditional first question, or at least it's my preferred first questions on my New Books Network interviews. And that is a very simple, why did you write this book? And I think this is particularly interesting because it's really a memoir. You're not old. You're in midlife, so it is interesting, and I think it will be interesting to the listeners to know why you decided to write this book.
Well, the decision to kind of put the memoir elements in it was, you know, sort of came along the way, but I've been mulling over writing something on one of the central themes of the book about the rise of populism in the United States for some time, even prior to ending up in the Trump administration in, you know, 2017. And I, from the very beginning of my career, my emergence, I would say, in the United States in 1989, when you and I met, when I came to Harvard, I'd been really struck by the parallels between the UK, the United States, and Russia on one major front, which was tied to my own personal biography, which was the massive changes in the economy and in the structure of industry beginning in the 1980s, but I suppose in many respects going back to the 1960s and 1970s, in the way that, you know, the world moved away from mass manufacturing and heavy industry, the way that everything had been built up after World War II, and the fact that it had similar impacts in all of those three countries. So it's something that I'd observed for an awfully long time, that, you know, you get these huge dislocations in society. So I grew up in the north of England. My dad was a coal miner. He was from multiple generations of coal miners. My whole county, my region in the north of England, County Durham in the northeast of England, was synonymous with coal mining. People talked about the Durham Miners. There was a Durham Miners Association that was part of the National Union of Mine Workers in the United Kingdom. It had massive political impacts within the UK. the Durham Miners Gala, the kind of like celebration of mining, you know, every year, every politician in Britain would kind of go there. They had like big political clout. And they were also like the backbone of the Industrial Revolution. And in fact, mining had been going on in the north of England since the Roman period. There were little kind of coal mines that the, you know, the Romans obviously run in a different way, I imagine. But the whole region was one of mining. And when I was born, the mines were all closing. The whole region was being turned on its head. And as I got into my, you know, phase of political awareness, which we all kind of reached sometime, you know, in our teens, when I was about 14, Margaret Thatcher became the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, 1979. And Thatcher wanted to turn the British economy around, modernise it, you know, move away from this mass manufacturing, heavy industrial profile and nationalised industry in the UK. Because after World War II, the coal mines, the steelworks, the shipyards, the railways, you know, you name it, had been nationalised by the government because of the devastation of World War II to the British economy, and that private owners of all of these enterprises were incapable of really raising the resources to build, you know, the country back up again and build the economy back up. So the government had to step in. And those industries remain nationalised basically until Margaret Thatcher comes along. And she engages in this mass privatisation. And it results in these tussles with the miners' union, with all kinds of, you know, other sectors of the British economy, and it results in mass layoffs because privatisation and modernisation lead to shrinkage and removing the economy into the service sector, the new knowledge-based economy. You need different educational skills. You need things in different places. And hundreds of thousands of people in my region lose their jobs all at once. And so I'm a product of post-industrial decline. My dad, you know, lost his job in the coal mines in the 1960s, then he churned through jobs in the steelworks, those disappeared, the brickworks, and he ends up working in the National Health Service, which also becomes a sort of a tale for, you know, America and other places, led to the care economy, you know, that's emerging. That's still nationalised, isn't, you know, fully privatised, but the National Health Service becomes the only real source of employment for people like my father, who's only skilled in one particular profession, a coal miner, and has no other skills or educational qualifications to translate into something else. So every porter in the hospital, every orderly, every auxiliary worker used to work in some kind of big nationalised industry. In fact, most of the porters, and my father worked for the hospital, were all ex-miners, with one exception. So everybody's kind of looking for something else. My dad was lucky to have a job, but a lot of the people that I grew up with didn't have jobs and didn't get jobs for years. And in the 1980s, when I was thinking about what I would do with myself, I had this great opportunity to go to university because it was going to be paid for by my local education authority because I was from such a poor background. My father basically said to me, this is the title of the book, there's nothing for you here, pet. You know, if you have an education, don't come back. You're going to have to go off somewhere else. So there's that whole kind of dislocation and displacement that comes out of this, you know, people realizing there's no opportunity in their own areas. And once I start to study Russian and I get to the Soviet Union, I see the same thing happening. The Soviet Union, you know, and when you and I were working on together, it was already Russia, modern Russia, because the Soviet Union falls apart when we're kind of partway through doing our degrees. But the Soviet Union has ground to a halt. Central planning has failed. The economy's failed. You know, Mikhail Gorbachev is there trying to kind of wrest the economy into that, you know, 20th century footing, following much of the same pattern that you've seen in the United Kingdom as well. And in the 1990s, when the Soviet Union falls apart, under Boris Yeltsin, a group of reformers do exactly what Margaret Thatcher did, which is try to privatize this massive edifice of heavy industry and manufacturing industry. And the Soviet Union and Russia are exactly like the northeast of England. They're the smokestack industries, the big plants, you know, the big factories, the coal mines, the shipyards, the steelworks. And I, like you, see the same thing happening in real time. And I'm immediately struck by this is just like home. The same thing is happening. And in the United States, when you and I were studying in Harvard, you know, kind of in that late 1980s, early 1990s, it's happening in Massachusetts as well. Outside of the walls of Harvard Yard, places like Somerville and Medford and East Cambridge and all the way across Boston, the old industries are disappearing. People have lost their jobs. Textile mills are closing down in, you know, in and around Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And the old industry is disappearing. And at that point, the new industry hasn't come in. And you're kind of seeing unemployment, dislocation, certainly not, you know, behind the rarefied walls of Harvard Yard, but all you have to do is step outside and, you know, go to some of the other places and see it happening. And, you know, that dislocation, people feeling displaced, not quite sure what's going to happen to them. And you kind of fast forward and this starts to have political impacts. Because unlike in and around Harvard and Cambridge, where there's Harvard and MIT, and you get this new knowledge economy that kind of builds up and eventually people find new jobs, in many of the other parts of the world, particularly in the northeast of England and also parts of Russia, outside of Moscow, nothing new appears. And people get frustrated, they get angry, their identity disappears with the workplace. And this is a fantastic fertile ground for populist leaders who come in and say, I'm going to make things great again for you. I'm going to come in and fix things. I'm going to get you jobs back. I'm going to put things back to where it was, because there's nothing there for people in the future. Forgotten places, forgotten people. And I was always very acutely aware of this. When I started working on Russia, I became very interested in this fact. I started looking in the Russian case at Siberia, these huge cities that were built up after World War II, especially in the 1970s, with the exploitation of natural resources. And all of those cities like fall apart because they're kind of mono industry places, big steelworks, big metallurgy, you know, huge mines. I mean, on a scale that's, you know, unfathomable from even the perspective of the United States, let alone, you know, the UK. And millions of people are kind of stuck in the middle of nowhere, and the world's moved on without them. And, you know, I guess I've been constantly exploring that whole and unpacking what happened to me as a kid and what happened to my family and my region, and trying to understand it in a larger context. And then, you know, I end up in the Trump administration. We could talk about how I got in there, because it's not just I just you know, but I then see populism in the United States at work. And of course, Trump is elected not by Vladimir Putin and the Russian security services, as some people assume, but by American voters in counties that are now part of what the Americans called the Rust Belt. And that didn't used to be the Rust Belt. That was the heartland of manufacturing industry, heavy, you know, industry in that big buildup after World War II. That was the motor, literally, particularly the motor manufacturing of the new post-war US economy. But with the post-1980s, service sector, you know, finance-based, knowledge economy, those places just like the northeast of England and vast swathes of, you know, Russia from Siberia to just outside of Moscow have all been left behind. And in all of those places, you see populist politics develop. They kind of look for a strong man or somebody or something that can fix the situation and bring jobs and opportunity back to those places. And so after I have this experience in the Trump administration, which ends up me being a fact witness in the first impeachment trial, and seeing our political, you know, partisan infighting, the polarization that we have, you know, I feel like I get it. I understand what's been happening from a, particularly this socioeconomic and this kind of political and historical sense. And I went into the government worried about what Russia was up to. I come out of the government really worried about what's happening to the United States. And I think that, well, let me try to put all of this together. I've been on my own personal odyssey of trying to understand since I was 14. You know, I've kind of figured out a few things. I've done it in a kind of strange sort of way via Russia and, you know, kind of coming to the United States. But let me kind of lay this all out to how we kind of got here. And then some thoughts that I've had about how we might be able to get out of it. Because I feel that, you know, here in the United States, we're in one of those pivotal moments where, in fact, our democracy is imperiled by all of these socioeconomic and other issues that date back really to that whole dislocation of the 1980s, that move from one type of economy to the next. And we're about to do that again, because now we're going to have another move, another huge leap, quantum leap in our economies to artificial intelligence, the move into these, you know, new green technologies, or battery operated electric vehicles, all of kind of the new sectors that are emerging. And there's going to be displacement again, because manual workers, you know, have been long gone. But even people who were retooled for the new knowledge economy post 1980s, you know, early 2000s, are not going to be equipped for the next phase either. And so are we going to just keep on doing this again? Or, you know, how can we start to address this whole kind of issue of how we grapple with these massive changes, which result in changes of opportunity for people?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about two things. One is the thesis, and I think it's correct, that there's something about these dislocations that makes people flee toward populism, however defined. And I'd like you to begin by talking a little bit about that. I'm from the Midwest and other areas elected Trump. These are my people. Actually, the town I grew up in, Wichita, Kansas, is largely on the map because of wheat and aircraft factories one of the things about Wichita is it is surrounded by aircraft factories that were built during, well, starting before World War II, but during World War II, to build bombers to level Japanese and German cities. Those aircraft factories, some of them still exist, and they still employ a lot of people there. But I'd be interested in your thoughts about what is it about these dislocations that makes people flee to populism and away from, I guess, what I might call irrational politics?
Well, I think it really depends in many respects on the length of time that elapses from, you know, these dislocations. I mean, you know, can you be dislocated forever? You know, when does a crisis become just a sort of a permanent state of being? And then the frustrations that come with that. So, you know, we could take Wichita, Kansas, we could take any kind of, you know, place in the American Midwest that, you know, as you pointing out, was ramped up in terms of its manufacturing economy to meet the exigencies of wartime. And then afterwards, you know, moved into the sort of like the peacetime economy, you know, maybe still making military aircraft, but also commercial aircraft, for example, or, you know, kind of tank factories became automobile factories, obviously, in, you know, places like Michigan and, you know, Detroit, you know, kind of, you know, writ large, where GM and Ford and others, you know, are still kind of major employers. Or, you know, you can look at a place like, you know, where I came from in County Durham in the northeast of England, when the mines closed down, steelworks closed down, nothing else came in. And you've had that for decades. And people who could move, like myself, moved and never came back. But a lot of people couldn't move at all. And, you know, why couldn't they move? Well, there's lots of different reasons. In part, it's qualifications. You know, the local education system was all sort of set up to feed people into a factory, a coal mine. You know, they weren't being kind of set up or given the skill set to develop their own business, you know, for example, entrepreneurial skills. I mean, my education at school was not different from my parents and grandparents. In fact, I had some of the same as textbooks that my grandma in 1904, you know, kind of was using, you know, kind of, I remember that vividly. My grandma had a copy of a textbook that she'd had from school. And I was like, ah, it's the same thing. There's nothing new happened in the world, you know, since the 1920s, you know, particularly as Britain was losing its empire by then. It's kind of a little odd to be taught things from the same, you know, sort of perspective. But that just underscores the point that, you know, the systems, educational systems didn't come up. And there wasn't, you know, still the same, there wasn't mechanisms put in place for retraining, reskilling. Wasn't funding for that, you know. So people kind of weren't qualified in a way, you know, to be able to move somewhere else. Then there was the issue of that this is multiple generations of people, people who moved in, you know, perhaps in Kansas and elsewhere. They might have done it, moved in for farming, you know, way back, you know, in the period of the settlement of the Midwest and on the way out to the West. So they've got multiple generations going back to, say, what, the 1870s, 1880s. You know, so while your family is there, that's the same phenomenon in the northeast of England. People in that same time frame came into work in the all of the emergent industries of the Industrial Revolution. They moved from the farm to, you know, the factory and the mine and the shipyard and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And multiple generations might have moved about in search of jobs, but they're all in that same area. I mean, my dad's father was a coal miner, his brother was a coal miner, all of his uncles, his great uncles, his great grandfather, and his grandfather after him. I mean, it's basically everybody, you know, and they all grew up in these small towns, and they might move around, but they were all in the same kind of profession, and all these generations of people live together. It's hard to do to leave. You essentially become a refugee. You become dislocated from the human capital that you've invested in and built up over time. And then again, you know, in the United Kingdom, you know, a lot of people didn't own their own houses. So they're in rental properties. So they don't, and they haven't built up, they haven't got any assets. They can't to liquidate or anything. They haven't got a car. I mean, nobody I knew and my relatives had a car. We had a bike and you'd take the bus, you know, and if the job wasn't in your immediate area, and all at once everybody loses their jobs in this region, you can't just move to the next town and village as, you know, relatives would have done for work. My dad moved about from mine to mine for a while. Where do you go? You don't have information. You don't have contacts. You know, it's not kind of like, you know, how to get there, and you don't have the money to move. And then you might not be able to afford a rental property in somewhere else. In the United States, that was often a lot easier, though mobility has really shrunk down here in the US. People are not as geographically mobile as they used to be. But there was cheaper, you know, gasoline, people had cars, the mass growth of, you know, individual car ownership, the Greyhound bus network, and, you know, if you couldn't take the train. But it was kind of, there was that earlier expectation of moving, you know, the rental market. But then, of course, we had the Great Recession that you know, took out the bubble out of housing. But people get shackled in the United States by healthcare and healthcare benefits. And again, another factor of an artifact of World War II, when the government didn't want to have wage inflation and other inflation as a result, and then had the workplace offer benefits like healthcare as a kind of increase in wages. But all that has the effect of is tying people in place. In the UK, healthcare goes no matter where you go because you've got a national health service, but everything else becomes more problematic. So people get trapped. And the whole point of this is when you're trapped, you kind of, after a while, you get frustrated. You don't sort of trust people who kind of, you know, say they're going to fix things. But sometimes you're willing to have a gamble. And, you know, when a person comes along and says, I get it, I'm listening to you. And you know, your cultural identity is all tied up with this, with all this change. Someone somewhere else seems to be doing better than you. And they don't always look like you or sound like you or come from your kind of background. There's the immigration element. You know, there's all these other kind of changes, or there's this elite that emerges, the people who are qualified and get all the opportunities and you get none. And so you become resentful, or you see all of this and you become, you know, nobody's really representing you. Nobody's giving you a voice. So if somebody suddenly comes along like Trump did, or, you know, others in other sectors, I hear you, I'm listening to you. You know, you might gamble on them, might give them a chance and say, okay, yeah, great. You're going to be my champion. You're going to fight there. And then, you know, if nothing else, you're going to show these others, you know, what it's like to be me. And to, you know, not get anything and not get anywhere and to see your life taken away from you and things changed. So there's, you know, that grievance politics. But there's also that desire for people to have something to change. We saw that in Russia. You know, I mean, you and I, when we were looking at this, the 1990s was a disastrous period for most ordinary Russians. They saw a whole bunch of oligarchs emerge, people who took advantage of the privatization process, you know, took all the prime assets, the plums, the jewels of the Russian economy, and former ministers, you know, suddenly become the private owners of the sector they'd been ministers in the Soviet period. Ordinary people, you know, lose their job, lose their housing, you know, they're kind of stuck. And then somebody like Putin comes along and says, well, that was all chaos. This was kind of crazy. I'm going to fix it for you. And, you know, he gets the support of, you know, the old former working class stiff, of course that was all Russians, and they, you know, kind of basically give him the benefit of the doubt, and he's a populist leader because he has no party, there's no, you know, kind of larger political, well, there's the state around him, but there's no political party, there's no real kind of checks and balances, it's him and the public, he's directly elected. Just like in the United States, you've got a direct election of the president. So it becomes this personality, this popular figure who's reading the polls. In Putin's case, he has these incredible town halls for hours on end where he communes with the people directly on everything from potholes to, you know, some kid who can't afford a ballet tutu, and he says he'll go out and get that for them. I mean, these are little examples. Somebody suddenly appears like fairy godmother with a ballet tutu. It's all been set up, you know, kind of in advance, and some shoes and a whole thing for the little girl in Siberia who wanted to be in the Nutcracker recital or something, or the potholes in Omsk that have never been filled, and suddenly, you know, in real time, trucks appear and start filling the potholes. I mean, it's that kind of populist touch. I can fix everything. I can do this for you. You just have to appeal to me directly. And that's going to be Trump's appeal as well. I hear, you know, what you're saying. I see it. I know you're angry about all this. I'm going to be your champion. I'm going to out and fight these elites who have never done anything for you for years. I'm going to do something for you. And yeah, people can gamble on that, right?
I mean, I really like what you said about a gamble
being done.
Because that was the sense I got from many people who voted for Trump, is that it was a gamble. It was like, we've seen what everybody else has. We don't want that anymore. This person is appealing to me directly because I'm kind of screwed. And we understand that he's a weirdo, but heck, why not? Let's try that. And it wasn't really a rational process because he related to people and relates to people on such an emotional level. You love that guy or you hate him.
Yeah.
He's nice.
It's emotional. It's entertainment. I mean, there's the interesting, you know, kind of fact that many people voted for Trump for the same reason that they'd actually previously voted for Barack Obama. Seen as an outsider from the process, he's giving hope in a, you know, completely, you know, different way. I mean, I know from my own extended family here, people who voted for Obama both times and would have voted for him again if he'd run again, and then voted for Trump both times again. Because it's kind of like they didn't want the kind of establishment who's given them absolutely nothing. I know after a time, people become the establishment if they're in, you know, power long enough. But Trump is never going to be that establishment figure because he is you know, kind of basically a wild card figure, somebody who's a kind of a law unto himself. He's endlessly entertaining. this is kind of like, and he sticks it to, it's like a big middle finger, you know, extended to all the people that people really resent because of everything that they've done at their expense.
It really is. In January, during the election cycle, before Trump was elected that November, I remember sending an email to a couple of friends of mine in which I predicted that Trump would be elected because he's in the party of FU.
I can feel that same sense of, you know, grievance, frustration, and, you know, wanting to have the same gesture. Honestly, I felt that growing up, you know, we felt the same way. Like, everybody just doesn't care at all about us, you know, kind of the only way that we get out of this circumstance is to leave. And lots of people don't want to leave. And they want, you know, somebody to be out there fighting for them. And they want to show it to everybody else as well. And that's in Russia too. There's a kind of a, we'd call it in the north of England, a bloody-mindedness, sort of like a kind of feeling that, well, okay, if we can't get anything, then let's just stick it to everyone else so they can see how we feel. Not just, you know, how do we kind of get ahead and how do we get out of this predicament? And as I saw this in all three places, you know, it was also, you know, fairly obvious that to me as well, that, you know, Trump would prevail in 2016, and why? It wasn't, again, Russian security services, more that sentiment in, you know, kind of other places where people feel like, okay, it's our time to make our voice heard. And the same happened in the UK in 2016 with Brexit. Later with the 2019 general election, when, you know, the same phenomenon of previously, you know, dyed-in-the-wool blue Democratic states and counties voting for the Republicans, breaking the blue wall. The same thing happened in the north of England. People thought, well, why am I voting for the Labour Party? There's been decades here since the 1980s. Labour have been in power in the 90s under Tony Blair, and they did some things, but not that much. And then they all come and they give us all these promises and they don't really do anything. And they kind of send officials up here to get safe seats who don't even know where they are. They're not from the locality. You know, we get nothing. Let's vote for the ruling party, the party who are in power, the Conservatives, this guy Boris Johnson, give them a chance because he's got a wild card phenomenon. So in 2019, places like my hometown, having never voted anything other than Labour or maybe the old style Liberals, you know, back in the, you know, the before Labour, they vote for the Tories for the very first time ever for the Conservative Party. So they're giving it a gamble.
It's a gamble. It really is. And it's a kind of... It's something to think about that the American electoral system can't present people with better options than they have, but that's a different conversation. I know your time is very valuable and it's a little bit short. We've talked a little bit about the Trump administration, the rise of Trump, and you've done a good job, I think, of understanding why Trump was elected. But I want to talk a little bit about your entry into the Trump administration. I know from personal correspondence to you that this was a difficult decision for you, and it also has cost you in various ways. And I think that listeners would be very interested in understanding your thinking when you decided to go ahead and take the invitation of the Trump administration and work there. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, the decision-making process was really shaped by national security. So by, you know, kind of all of the work that I've ever done on Russia. And, you know, you and I, as you said, we start off as Russia hands and nobody thinks of that anymore. I've been working on Russia for all of my, you know, sentient adult life. You know, I started studying Russian in 1984, you know, against the backdrop of the miners' strike in the UK. But also, yeah, exactly. We have exactly the same starting point. It's the Cold War scare, right? The ultimate scare of the Euro missiles crisis. That's why you and I started studying Russian. You were in the US and I was in the UK, and we were worried that we were going to end up in a massive nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. And suddenly sitting in the UK, we thought we'd be ground zero for nuclear Armageddon. That would be us, poof, gone in one big mushroom cloud and into the nuclear winter and all the rest of it. And that tended to concentrate the mind. So as a young, you know, person in high school, you know, despite my humble origins, I thought, well, maybe I could go off and become an interpreter. Maybe I could try to sort of understand, you know, what's happening. Maybe one day I could help interpret an arms control negotiation, just anything to do something practical rather than just sit around waiting to be blown up. At least I'm, you know, trying to you know, basically address the sum of all my fears. So, you know, I go off and then, you know, I meet and, you know, I've spent this whole long time just really trying to get into the psyche of Russia. I mean, you and I, we've done history, we've done culture. You know, I'd written a book about Vladimir Putin, trying to understand him and his motivations with a, you know, a colleague. You know, I've got these decades of work on Russia. And Russia's interfered in our election, and what a mess. You know, there's a huge mess domestically. But there's also, how do we go about, you know, heading off more of the same? But also, how do we try to put this relationship on a different footing? I mean, the whole impulse all the way since the 1980s has been, how do we stop this confrontation, the crisis? Can we find some modus vivendi in, you know, kind of with the Russians, something that just like works to manage this confrontation and conflict, not to kind of have us in a strategic partnership or anything like that? That's long gone. I mean, we had these fantasies in the 1990s, but how can we just stabilize this in some way? And so, you know, I'd been in the government before, the National Intelligence Council. Some of the people who I'd worked with there, you know, were now either getting detailed over to the new Trump administration, or they'd actually, a couple of them had even been in the campaign, like General Flynn, very different person from the person I worked with when I was the National Intelligence Council. It was almost like it was two different General Flynns. But in any case, he was one of the people who approached me, and other people that he'd brought on board that I'd worked with before at the National Intelligence Council. And I felt like, well, you know, I really have to do this from the national security perspective. But on the personal level, I mean, this was, you know, I write in the book that I'd taken part in the Women's March the day before getting called into. People said, how the hell could you? I mean, the friend I went with, you know, said to me, I just couldn't speak to me for weeks. He's like, what? And I said, look, I mean, this was a protest for all women. I mean, there were women of every imaginable background, and many fathers and daughters and husbands and their wives and brothers and their sisters there, just basically making a stand against the misogyny and sexism that we saw, you know, in the campaign. It wasn't just Trump. It was just kind of, you know, writ large. It was still a big problem in society. So that was a, and so like, I did think to myself, okay, I'm a woman. I'm going to have to go in there, you know, every day as a woman. I'm also an immigrant. And there's been this horrible anti-immigration stance and racism and everything else. I'm just going to go in there and be myself and stick to my principles every single day. But I really felt that I had to do it from the national security perspective. But I had a lot of people who said, don't do it. You know, you're kind of going to be people who believe that Trump had colluded with Putin. You're going to be aiding and abetting a criminal enterprise. And I can't speak to you again if you make this decision. Some of them still haven't. And occasionally I get a nasty gram, you know, kind of here and there, still saying, still can't forgive you no matter what you've done since. And others, you know, kind of giving me very stark warnings about, you know, all the things that could happen. I don't think even they could have envisaged some of the things that did happen, actually. you know, but event, and then others saying, look, it's your duty. You really do need to go in and do this. And others saying, go in there, but, you know, give yourself a limited time frame. I mean, one of the best pieces of advice I got was from someone, a colleague at the Brookings Institution, Martin Indyk. He was at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he, you know, obviously worked in the Middle East space. He'd been the ambassador to Israel. He'd been the Middle East envoy, assistant secretary for the Near East. He's Australian originally. And, you know, a naturalized citizen like myself in the national security space. And he said, you've got to make sure that you're part of a solution, not part of a problem. As soon as you realize that you're becoming part of a problem, get out of there. And he said, and even better, give yourself just a limited time. And I'd been loaned out by Brookings to the National Intelligence Council for a 2-year term, and then it was supposed to be renewed for another 2-year term. And I got half the way through that second term. And I thought, okay, 2 years, that sounds good. And then perhaps I'll avoid the campaign, you know, kind of when the campaign for re-election starts up again. Well, as I learned, the campaign never stopped. And it got pretty hairy and unpleasant. And, you know, right from the beginning, it was a bit of a nightmare, because then I got all kinds of other attacks, you know, kind of from other people I didn't even know, you know, very unfriendly fire from, you know, fellow Americans and political operatives and all kinds of things. So it was kind of in some respects worse than, you know, kind of anticipated. But also at the same time, there were some amazing people that I was working with, people who were non-partisan detailees from across the government, public servants from all backgrounds, many of the people who people saw testifying alongside me, and then people who were political appointees who were partisan, but they were, you know, Republicans, you know, the kind of people I'm not partisan at all, but the people I'd worked with in the Bush administration. And, you know, we were all working together on the same mission, which was trying to protect American national security and then deal with the incoming, you know, fire from all of this, you know, kind of crazy chaotic politics that we found ourselves in the middle of. But the decision was really on national security. But yes, it did come at an enormous personal cost.
Yeah, I find it very interesting, because there's a question in everybody's mind who is a professional, and we are professionals. We are trained to do this work. For whom should we work? And at what point do we say, okay, I can't work with this person or in this administration or with this company? And again, this is a common thing. I do find it somewhat surprising that people didn't think, well, Fiona is a professional and she's been called by her government to help in national security issues. She will go and do a good job. That's what I thought when I saw you'd been appointed. I was like, well, that's a good choice. She'll do a good job. And I wonder if you see like that shifting a little bit, because again, this is surprising that people that we've known for years apparently really took umbrage when you went.
Well, they did. I mean, I think if we're going back again, you know, to 2016, 2017, when this all came back, I would still do it. I would go back and do it again.
Yeah.
However, if I was asked to join the Trump administration in 2024, I absolutely would not.
Mm-hmm. That's fair enough. So let me ask this question.
Yeah. Public service is, you know, very important. And, you know, I think that everybody has to sort of step up on all hands on deck.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we have a return of President Trump as the individual, the person who is from the FU party and not from
the FU party. I don't think I'd work for the FU party either.
To lie about, you know, kind of everything. Then we're in a whole different realm. As I describe in the book, the ghost of Christmas future is staring us in the face of a kind of a Russia-type scenario where we've moved into autocracy and on an authoritarian path and away from the principles of the preamble of the Constitution of We the People. So me, the one and only, you know, kind of person who, you know, has no association with anything else.
Right. So this is a very open-ended question, and I don't know if you can even answer it. It's what you said, you know, you entered and you will be yourself and you will stand by your principles. Were you able to do that, or to what extent were you able to do that when you were in government?
I was able to do it. I mean, again, that also came at, you know, some personal cost as well, because, you know, there were people inside of, you know, the kind of particularly the White House, West Wing, or political operative types who tried their utmost to get rid of me all the time. And, you know, that was kind of
constantly like going out
to the media, telling lies about me, lies that persist, you know, still out there on the internet, saying I was this, that, and the other. I was accused of being anonymous for a while, which, of course, now we know who anonymous was. Nobody ever kind of came back and said, oh, sorry about that. You know, kind of it was just, you know, whatever they could accuse me of, all kinds of strange conspiracy theories. But you know what? What prepared me for this, honestly, Marshall, was studying the Stalinist era.
Go ahead, explain that. Yeah,
you know, when you basically spent a lot of time in various, you know, classes, hearing about the purges and the denunciations, you thought, God, what was that like? Well, I had plenty of that. You know, that idea of denunciation, denos. You know, when you looked into the files, a lot of the archives were opened in the time, you know, that we were studying history. You saw the people weren't denouncing, you know, their fellow Russians or Soviets for any kind of ideological reason. It was just for pure venal issues. People would, you know, denounce their next-door neighbor because they wanted the next-door neighbor's wife, or they wanted the next-door neighbor's wife's coat, or they wanted the next-door neighbor's apartment. And there was just all of this, like, petty behavior. And unfortunately, I witnessed a lot of that. You know, a lot of it was kind of people's own personal interest, getting you out the way so they could get into the position, not because they wanted to do something on a national security perspective, because they had their own personal private agendas. And that was, to me, shocking on the one hand because it's the United States. I was not expecting that. But it was also, I thought myself, wow, well, you know, I know this from another setting. So actually, you know, I can get my head around it and I can kind of figure out how to manage it. And I'm just not going to take it personally because, you know, I presume I wasn't going to get sent to the gulag or, you know, shot by a firing squad. I mean, there's worries about personal violence though, because people were on the, you know, internet still continue to say I should die. And, you know, kind of.
I grew up in
went to a rough school. So, you know, been there, you know, done that as well, where, you know, people would say that to your face. They wouldn't just, you know, say it anonymously on the internet. So, you know, in some respects, I do kind of feel very grateful for my personal life training, you know, back in the hard scrabble northeast of England, where I'd seen it all. And then for my studies of, you know, pretty warped societal systems in, you know, the Soviet period under Stalin. But it's a sad commentary on the United States that I had to, in this particular junta, I had to dig deep into those kinds of backgrounds to deal with that kind of situation. Because that's not what anybody expects of the United States. The power of our example as a positive example has not just been tarnished, but I think has been pretty ruined by this episode.
Yes, it's not been a good thing for the image of the United States around the world. There's no question about that. And I do think that, you know, the denunciation is, for some reason, it's become a powerful thing. And it has been before, you know, in the McCarthy era, you could say someone was a communist and ruin their life. And now you can say various things on Twitter and I don't know about ruin their life, but you can damage them in various ways. And you have to be, if you want to be a public figure, which I do not, and I don't really envy anyone who is, you have to be very thick-skinned and have a lot of support. So I imagine you had a lot of support during this because...
Yeah, and I also didn't engage on the internet. I don't have a blog. I'd never had a Twitter account. I'm just staying away from it. I try not to read the crap that, you know, people write about me. I have, you know, plenty of people tell me about it. But I try to stay away from it.
Well, I think that's very sensible. I don't really spend any time on Twitter myself, and I don't really see how anything sensible can come of, what is it, 63 characters?
I think it's more than that now. I believe it's like 280.
I don't know, but I had to
correct that in the book because I put 140 characters, which was what I thought it was before, and then somebody said, no, it's been increased to 240. I was like, there you go then.
I don't know, but nothing sensible really can be said in 240 characters.
It's just, you know, it's like the old agitprop, you know, kind of from the Soviet period, sloganeering and, you know, kind of just getting an idea out there.
Yeah, there's no discourse or deliberation to be had on Twitter. It cannot happen. It physically cannot happen. So
no, it's just very blunt interactions, not even engaged.
I always think of it as gesturing, you know, and that's what chimps do. Chimps can't talk. They can gesture. They can throw feces at you.
and
it seems to me a lot of what happens on Twitter is feces throwing. I don't, you know, I'm not speciesist or anything like that, but I do like to think I'm more intelligent than a chimp. Although I think there are probably people who disagree. So anyway, Fiona, let me thank you very much for your time. We have a traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now? Do you have a next project, or is there something going on that you want to pitch or talk about, or what are you working on?
Well, in a way, I mean, obviously the book just came out at the beginning of October, and the book is a bit of a challenge to myself as well. I mean, there was a lot of issues that I raised in the book that I haven't quite fully resolved, and I'd like to move forward in, you know, exploring more of them as well. I mean, particularly on this kind of practical side of how do we start to fix ourselves, you know, be able to restore some more comity and civility in our politics, which is going to be very hard. I mean, I'm not being naive about it. How can we build some bridges, particularly on particular issues? And, you know, foreign policy, for example, how did foreign policy become such a divisive issue? It never used to be. You know, national security perspective, might be differences in how you would approach something, but it used to be more of a kind of a common perspective. The idea that, you know, there was an American shared interest, which has disappeared now. You know, but how can we, you know, the theme of the book is of opportunity. This whole issue of now you only have a 7% chance of doing the kind of journey that, you know, I did from the bottom, you know, 20% of society, top 20% or even further, you know, kind of in my case. You know, that was the whole fundamental premise of America. The America that I came to is a land of opportunity, the America that you're born into. You know, I had an amazing opportunity. In some respects, my, you know, story, life story is the American dream. But it's not the case for so many other people. And so I want to think myself about what can I do, you know, personally. I think we all can do something. We all have agency. It's not about one guy in the White House, but about how all of us, you know, can play a part here to do something to increase opportunity, to turn things around, to give people a stake in the system, to stake in our policy. So I'm thinking really hard now as the, kind of, depending on how people interact with the book, I'm getting great letters from people, all kinds of ideas. So I'm just thinking really concretely now about steps that I can personally take in conjunction with others to try to address some of these issues, not just write the book and then, you know, disappear.
Right, exactly.
How I can actually use it myself as something to build on, to move forward and do something.
Well, Godspeed, and from your lips to God's ears. And that's absolutely terrific. So Fiona, let me say thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Marsh. It's great to be with you again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.